Investors? You mean terrorists, don't you? Terry blurted out the words, wishing she could retract them. Benedict's eyes locked on hers.
I see I've underestimated you again. No matter. In response to your statement, labeling one a terrorist or freedom fighter depends more on one's politics than actions. Were the British colonists of the late 1700s violent? My new Arab affiliates allow me to monopolize the world's new power source in ways the Western world never would. I am by nature an explorer. I desire access to new frontiers. As such, I have no interest in seeing my resources bound by judicial and legislative branches.
Benedict grabbed her arm, escorting her out of the lab.
Within the next 48 hours, the Benthos shall arrive in Devil's Purgatory. With the combined mining efforts of the Prometheus and the Epimetheus, we should be able to clear the seafloor of nodules fairly quickly. Thanks to the Tanaka Institute, the Benthos will ascend from the abyss without the United States or Japan having a clue as to what our actual mission was.
Terry felt ill, her hands trembling. What are you going to do with me?
I haven't decided. You've grown on me. Becoming a pet project of sorts, the thought had occurred to allow you to live out your days aboard the Benthos.
He smiled.
Tell me, my dear, do you find me the least bit attractive?
Ring of Fire. Bering Sea. Jonas shielded his eyes from the swirling debris as the helicopter touched down in the hospital parking lot. Waving to his nurse, he pulled open the passenger door and climbed into the familiar cockpit.
You look pretty good for a dead guy, Mac said.
Jonas gave his friend a quick handshake. Mac, I...
Forget it. I'll just edit your tab, which, by the way, is getting quite full. Seriously, though, I'm glad you finally got your head screwed on straight. For a while there, I was thinking about changing my name to Ishmael.
Jonas buckled his seatbelt as the chopper lifted off. How far are we from the William Beebe?
A few minutes. We docked last night in Dutch Harbor. By the way, Celeste left the ship early this morning.
Celeste is gone? Where'd she go?
A GTI chopper picked her up. Captain Morgan says she took her belongings with her.
That makes no sense, Jonas said, spotting the William Beebe in the distance. Why would she just leave after repairing the lagoon and spending so much money on recapturing the shark?
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with her leading you on while she was screwing Marin.
Celeste and Marin? Who told you that?
Marin, just before I dropped him off for a nature walk across the Alaskan frontier. He confessed to removing the firing pin on the grenade rifle, but swears he had nothing to do with cutting the line to the Zodiac.
Did you believe him?
Yes. Which means there's someone else on board who's not real fond of you. Any clues?
No. Jonas rubbed his eyes, trying to absorb everything at once. I don't get it. Why would Celeste come on so strong if she was sleeping with Marin?
Who the fuck knows? I say good riddance to both of them.
They joined the captain and Harry Moon in the control room.
Taylor, good to see you in one piece, the captain said. Now what's all this about changing our course?
I need you to take us to the Mariana Trench as quickly as possible.
Sorry, my orders are to complete repairs on the ship, then return to the Bering Sea to recapture the creature.
The Megalodon's not in the Bering Sea, Jonas said. She's headed for the trench.
If Dr. Marin were here, I think he'd disagree, Harry said, eyeing Max suspiciously.
Jonas searched through the ship's charts, removing a bathymetric map of the Pacific Ocean. Harry, I'm sure you're familiar with the Ring of Fire?
Actually, no.
Really, I'd have thought different. Doesn't matter. Jonas spread out the plastic chart. Using a red dry erase marker, he drew a line up the South and Central American Pacific coastlines clear up along the Pacific northwestern coast of the United States, continuing around Canada, Alaska, and the Aleutian Islands, then across the Pacific and south down along the coast of Japan to Indonesia. This is the Ring of Fire, a seismic area situated around the Pacific Rim that is home to more than 400 active volcanoes. Deep within the Earth, above the core and mantle, are roughly 14 tectonic plates that float like giant continental rafts across our planet's crust. Dynamic collisions along these plate boundaries produce earthquakes and violent volcanic eruptions, the most powerful occurring along this seismic ring.
What does all this have to do with the Megalodon? Harry asked.
During the last ice age, the ocean temperatures dropped, killing off most of the megalodons. The surviving members were able to inhabit an abyssal, insulated layer of warm water continuously being fed by hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. But the trench itself is part of the Ring of Fire, a convergent plate boundary created by the subduction of the Pacific Plate pushing beneath the Philippine Plate.
What's your point?
My point, Harry, is that these sharks are equipped with sensory systems that can use the Earth's own magnetic field, along with seismic vibrations in the fault lines, to orient themselves over long distances. When Angel's mother escaped from the trench 4 years ago, she instinctively headed east. first following the Hawaiian island chain, later moving north along the Central American coastline until she reached the Monterey Canyon. All of these locations are part of the Ring of Fire, as is the route Angel's been following since she escaped from the lagoon.
I thought she was just following the migratory course for whales, Harry stated.
So did I. Now I'm convinced the shark bypassed the Bering Sea. I think she continued southwest, following minute seismic vibrations emanating from the Aleutian Trench. Look here. Jonas pointed to the coast of Alaska. If Angel continued to follow the Aleutian Trench, she'd cross the northern Pacific and run directly into the Kamchatka and Kuril Trenches. These gorges continue southwest past the Kuril Islands before becoming the Japanese Trench, again all part of the Ring of Fire. The Japanese Trench empties into the Mariana Trench, the species' home over the last 1 million years or more.
It's like the shark's following some sort of underwater highway, Max said. I don't know, Taylor, Captain Morgan said. This monster could still be following the cetacean summer migration.
Jonas looked up at the captain. The megalodon's not following the whales. The female's entered a powerful state of estrus. Like some kind of giant salmon, she's using the Ring of Fire to navigate her way back to the Mariana Trench in order to breed. Taylor, Captain, please. My wife's in the trench. I need to get her out of there before it's too late. Western Pacific. 21 miles southwest of Kamchatka Peninsula. The captain of the 28-foot research vessel, Cachalot, turned his ship into the wind, allowing his crew to drop sail and drift in the 5-foot seas. A cold breeze whistled across the mast. The rising 3/4 moon peeked out from behind a cloud bank, casting its luminous glow on the ship's decking. Inside, sound engineer Janice Henkel adjusted her headphones and listened, reminding herself not to look at the Discovery camera pointing in her direction. She turned to face her husband.
Bruce, according to my latest calculations, Mad Max is now sleeping in 800 feet of water, hovering vertically directly below our boat. If his pattern holds, he should remain at rest for at least another 3 hours before continuing north.
And cut,
said Norton Binder, the Discovery producer.
Very good, Jen. Is the sperm whale definitely asleep?
That's what I just said.
Great, then let's use this opportunity to retake a few of the scenes we talked about earlier. Bruce, are you ready?
Jen's husband, biologist Bruce Henkel, clipped the microphone to his shirt, then adjusted his collar.
I'm ready.
Good, Norton said. Now this is just voiceover, so don't worry about the camera. Just read right from your notes. Josh, are you set?
Sound level's fine,
the cameraman called out.
Anytime.
Bruce cleared his throat. Reaching a length of 60 feet and weighing up to 45 tons, the male sperm whale is undoubtedly the most formidable predator on the planet. It was back in the early 19th century that whalers first hunted these leviathans, targeting sperm whales for their enormous yields of oil. Unlike baleen whales, the aggressive sperm bulls often fought back, their actions no doubt inspiring Herman Melville's classic tale, Moby Dick.
Great, much better than the last take, Norton said. Go to the next passage.
Larger and more aggressive than their female counterparts, bull sperm whales usually travel alone, their deep descents making the elusive hunters difficult to track in the open ocean. In order to learn more about these predators, the Cachalot will remain under sail, making as little noise as possible as we track the creatures with underwater microphones mounted in the ship's keel. Like their dolphin cousins, sperm whales use pulses of sound called echolocation to see their environment, a sensory system unique to toothed whales. Over the last 4 days, our expedition has been tracking an enormous bull we've nicknamed Mad Max. By listening in on the whale's underwater vocalization, Jan can pinpoint Max's location anywhere within a 5-mile radius.
Cut. Okay, folks, I'd say that was a solid day's work. Josh and I are going to call it a night. Be sure to wake us if anything interesting happens.
Jen watched the two men head for the guest quarters. She felt Bruce's strong fingers massaging her back.
That feels wonderful. I suppose this means it's my turn to stay up all night and listen to Max snore.
It is your shift.
Bruce kissed her on the back of the neck, then crawled into bed. Gliding silently in the southerly flow of the Anadyr Current, the female continued her southwesterly trek along the Asian coast, passing the Kuril Islands in 600 feet of water. Far below the creature loomed the depths of the Kuril Trench, its deepest point, the Vityaz Deep, dropping to almost 34,600 feet. Using the Aleutian Trench as a bearing, the albino predator had crossed the northern Pacific, following the Kamchatka Trench to the southwest. Moving past Cape Lopatka, the shark suddenly found itself swimming into the path of 1,000 whales, all migrating north to their summer feeding grounds in the Sea of Okhotsk. Like a hungry wolf descending upon a flock of sheep, the megalodon's sudden presence sent an immediate panic through the frightened pods.
The whales quickly established an alternate route, allowing the supreme hunter a wide berth, but not before she had slaughtered and fed upon a fin whale and her calf. Gliding through waters east of the Japanese island of Hokkaido, the megalodon now detected new vibrations, the faint yet powerful heartbeat of a creature the shark immediately recognized as another predator. 70 million years of primal instincts took over. The challenger's presence within the big female's domain had to be dealt with. Agitated, the megalodon increased her speed. The male sperm whale hovered vertically, motionless in 800 feet of pitch-dark ocean. Though silent and at rest, the whale never truly slept. Part of its brain was always on constant alert. Something approaching in the distance aroused the large bull. Opening its eyes, it slapped its enormous fluke several times, leveling itself out. The sperm whale shook its gargantuan head, rousing itself awake. Using its sonar-like clicks, it quickly located the charging megalodon. The bull circled, shaking its head in defiance as it awaited the arrival of its challenger. Jan Hankel closed her journal, then took a sip of coffee from her mug. The coffee was cold. As she stood to rewarm the beverage in the microwave, intense clicking sounds began chirping from the hydrophone.
"Bruce, wake up. It sounds like Max is on the move again."
The biologist rolled over in bed, groggy from lack of sleep.
"Tell that whale to go back to sleep."
Jan listened intently to the headphones.
"This is bizarre. He's not moving off. He's just circling around and around, 200 feet below us. Think he knows we're here?"
"I don't see how. I think we may be witnessing an undocumented type of sperm whale behavior."
Bruce rolled out of bed.
"Okay, I'll wait the discovery, guys."
The sperm whale waited until the megalodon closed to within several hundred yards before breaking from its defensive pattern. Beating its muscular fluke up and down furiously, the bull charged the albino shark, attempting to ram it with its mammoth head. Sensing danger, the megalodon banked sharply and circled away. The bull gave chase, but, unable to catch its quicker adversary, returned to its defensive posture. Though faster than the sperm whale, the megalodon could not attack the larger bull without risking a crushing butt to the head or devastating blow from its powerful fluke. The two behemoths continued circling, measuring each other, the bull occasionally making a run at the luminous shark, which darted away, only to return, looking for an opening.
"What's happening?"
Norton shouted, holding onto the mast as the boat began spinning in the whirling seas.
"Something else is down there with Max,"
Jan yelled.
"Another whale?" "No, we're only registering one set of clicks. Whatever it is, it sure has Max agitated." "We need to stay clear in case they breach,"
Bruce said as he gunned the boat's engine. The cachalot stopped spinning, its bow moving toward the edge of the turbulence. Although evenly matched in size with the megalodon, the sperm whale had one shortcoming not shared by its opponent. Being a mammal, it required air. Continuing to circle, the bull worked its way toward the surface to blow. The megalodon banked, launching its attack from below. Darting upward, the shark clamped down on the whale's small rounded pectoral fin, holding on like a pit bull. Mad Max bucked wildly as rows of serrated teeth sunk into its appendage. The crew of the cachalot turned to see the great head of the sperm whale plow upward through the surface. Then another creature appeared, this one snowy white, thrashing alongside. Before the crew could react, they found themselves in the middle of a battleground between two colossal titans. The sperm whale flung its head from side to side, sending 8-foot swells crashing against the small sailing boat. As waves began cresting over the side, Bruce grabbed his wife, gripping the wheel with his other hand. Meanwhile, the bull's fluke slapped the sea only feet from the cachalot's bow. Rolling sideways, the sperm whale fought furiously to shake its assailant loose, slapping its tail at the megalodon, which was thrashing about and tearing at the mouthful of flesh and bones clenched in its jaws. The bull's pectoral fin was no match for the shark's teeth, which quickly punctured the thick muscle of the whale's appendage clear down through the bone. Shaking its head savagely from side to side, the megalodon tore the sperm whale's severed forelimb from its body, shearing with it a bloody chunk of blubber. Savagely wounded, the bull whale whipped its enormous head around to face the shark, its long narrow jaw snapping in wild spasms as the enraged cetacean attempted to bite the megalodon's snout. Blood and froth rained upon the crew of the cachalot. Jan grabbed hold of her husband as the craft plunged sideways down a 10-foot trough. As the bow lifted precariously, she caught sight of the megalodon's ghastly upper jaw appear to jut forward from its mouth and slam shut on the sperm whale's lower jaw in a bone-splintering bite, crushing it with a sickening crunch. The 85,000-pound bull heaved its girth in agony along the surface, lashing out with its tail, while the remains of its mangled, dislocated lower jawbone dangled painfully below the underside of its head. Dark waves rolled over the cachalot's transom, depositing a slick film of whale oil and blood across her deck.
Bruce gunned the engine, distancing the sailboat from the tortured whale, which thrashed across the surface, stubbornly refusing to die. The bull whale rolled belly up to die. The alabaster dorsal fin raced past the cachalot's bow and disappeared. Bruce cut the boat's engines, terrified the sound might attract the creature. Moments later, Mad Max heaved in a final spasm of pain as the megalodon launched its attack from below, burying its teeth in the whale's back. A sickle of caudal fin lashed back and forth along the surface, sending lather in all directions. The crew of the sailboat huddled together on deck, horrified by the brutality of the attack and by their own vulnerability. Only Norton looked away, stealing a glance at his cameraman to make certain he was still filming. For the next 20 minutes, the megalodon continued its assault on the bleeding mass of blubber that had been Mad Max. Gradually, the torrent along the surface pushed the cachalot farther from the carnage. Bruce and his crew raised one of the sails, distancing themselves farther from the nightmarish beast. As the boat sailed away, Jan spotted a half-dozen lead-gray dorsal fins emerge from the darkness. Rather than approach the carnage, the great whites circled, waiting patiently for their larger cousin to finish feeding. Desperate Hours. Mariana Trench. Terry climbed the access tube ladder, entering the observation deck. Benedict was behind the bar, pouring himself a drink. Captain Prokovich, seated on a bar stool, gave her a look that made her want to retreat back down the passageway.
"Ah, there you are," Benedict said. "You're just in time. The benthos is about to begin its ascent along the canyon wall. What can I get you to drink?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing? Nonsense."
Benedict poured her a double shot of vodka, then walked around the bar, shoving the glass into her hand.
"À votre santé. To your health."
Benedict tossed back his drink, then said something in Russian to Captain Prokovich. Terry left the drink on the bar. She watched the one-eyed man descend to the bridge, sealing the hatch behind him. Benedict walked over to the control panel. He switched off the interior lights, then activated the retractable dome. The titanium barrier parted. A red glow from the exterior lights revealed the sheer rock face of the canyon wall, surrounded by the impenetrable darkness of the abyss. The benthos slowly ascended. Terry stifled a scream as two enormous chronosaurs glided past the bay window. Seconds later, a metallic boom jolted the ship.
"They're getting more aggressive," Terry whispered.
"They don't want us to leave. For some reason, they see us as a source of food."
Benedict picked up her drink from the bar and handed it to her, escorting her to the window.
"Watch. As we continue to rise closer to the current of hydrothermal soot insulating the bottom layer, the creatures will go into a positive frenzy."
Terry focused nervously on the 40-foot Kronosaurus slowly maneuvering between the face of the canyon wall and the observation window.
"Benedict, that one looks like it's going to charge."
As if in reply, the beast turned, rushing directly at them.
"Hear it! Benedict, what are you waiting for? Shut the dome!"
Benedict remained impassive. The monster's head grew immense, its eyes becoming specks of fire in the artificial light. Terry's heart pounded. She turned to run. Benedict pressed a button on the tiny remote control in his hand. Instantly, blazing white light shot out from the benthos, the blinding beacons igniting the abyss. The charging Kronosaurus pirouetted sharply, its upper torso quivering as if it had been struck by a 10,000-volt charge. Terry watched the creature nearly collide with the canyon wall, then disappear into the inky gorge. Benedict laughed. Terry drained her glass, then, feeling lightheaded, collapsed into a crushed velvet chair.
"You enjoy taunting me, don't you?"
"It's the schoolboy in me," Benedict said, flashing a triumphant smile. "Another drink?"
"No."
She watched the turbidity of the water increase as the benthos ascended through the dense layer of sulfur and minerals hovering above the trench like a blanket of smog. She heard faint crackling sounds, like pebbles colliding against the exterior window. And then they were through, rising above the hydrothermal layer, continuing to ascend along the face of the primordial canyon.
"The Kronosaurs won't follow?"
"No, they can't leave the hydrothermal layer," Benedict said. "The vents are the life support system of the abyss. Without them, the entire chemosynthetic food chain dies."
For a long moment she felt him staring at her. Then he descended to the bridge, leaving her alone with her thoughts.
"Benedict's never going to let me off the ship alive. It's up to me to save myself. I need to find a weapon. I need to kill him before he kills me."
An hour passed in eerie silence. At 24,312 feet, the benthos rose majestically above the canyon summit and over the small plateau separating the northern and southern regions of the Mariana Trench. Like a gigantic man-o-war, the great ship moved through the darkness, heading north, its exterior lights punching holes in the abyss, revealing a gray, barren expanse of seafloor covered in sediment. Terry stared into a seascape devoid of life, a veritable death valley beneath the waves. She imagined her lifeless body drifting along the bottom, her waterlogged flesh picked apart and devoured by dozens of white crabs. Hyperventilating, she clutched her hair as tears poured down her face, a cold sweat breaking out all over her body. Hugging a sofa cushion, she curled into a ball and closed her eyes, rocking back and forth. It took several minutes for Terry to regain her composure. She opened her eyes, staring at the ceiling. That's when she noticed the lens of the remote camera, focusing on her from the panel above. Pacific Ocean, 625 nautical miles northeast of Devil's Purgatory. Jonas and Max stood at the stern of the William Beebe. Sheets of plywood had been nailed into place over the damaged deck, a temporary wooden barrier serving as a rail. The cool night air whipped against their backs as they stared at the ship's churning wake.
"How soon until Omega enters the trench?"
Mac asked, turning his face as he soaked a rag in his hand with the clear liquid. "The report said Angel attacked the sperm whale off the coast of Japan. At the rate she's moving, a couple hours at the most."
"We'll fly out at first light."
Mac checked his watch.
"You ready?"
Jonas stared at the dark surface of the ocean, remembering his last encounter with the shark. "Yeah, let's get this over with." He followed Mac into the ship, then up a flight of stairs leading to the officers' quarters. Mac knocked on the cabin door. After a minute, Harry Moon opened the door, dressed in a t-shirt and boxers.
"Hey, fellas, it's kind of late."
"Sorry, but this is a bit of an emergency," Mac said. "It'll only take a minute."
Harry looked at them suspiciously.
"All right, come in."
He opened the door, allowing Mac and Jonas to enter.
"So, what's the emergency?"
"Somebody tried to kill me last week," Jonas said.
"What?"
Harry looked shocked.
"When?"
"That night off the Alaskan coast," Mac said.
"When you were attacked in the Zodiac? Are you sure?"
"We're sure," Mac said, circling about the small cabin. "The rope supporting the Zodiac was deliberately cut."
"We know who did it," Jonas said, "but we need your help dealing with the guy." Harry seemed nervous.
Maybe we ought to inform the captain?"
"No, we'd rather handle this ourselves," Jonas said as Mac whipped his arm around Harry from behind, pressing the rag of ether to his face in a vice-like grip. Harry opened his eyes and found himself on his back, staring up at the winch that had once held the Zodiac. He tried to speak, but a hand towel had been shoved in his mouth, duct tape covering his lips. Struggling to sit up, he realized his ankles and wrists were also bound in tape.
"Evening," Mac said, slipping the end of the rope around Harry's waist. "Nice night for a swim."
Jonas leaned over Harry. "You should have known about the Ring of Fire, Harry. That's basic knowledge to someone who's supposed to have a background in oceanography. I did some checking with some friends at Woods Hole. Turns out you've never been involved with the SOSUS program or the Institute. Fact is, you only received this assignment hours before the ship left port, when the real first officer mysteriously had to leave town to resolve a family matter. I don't know who you are, but you're about to become bait, just like you made me." Wide-eyed, Harry began mumbling something incomprehensible.
"What did he say?"
Mac asked, reversing the winch, the line pulling Harry to his feet. "I think he said he forgot his towel," Jonas said, tearing the tape from Harry's lips. Harry spit out the gag.
"Harry, it wasn't me. I swear, don't do this."
"You'll have to do better than that,"
Mac said, pushing him out over the side. Jonas released the winch. Harry uttered a scream as he plunged feet-first into the sea. Ice-cold water exploded the breath from his lungs as he was dragged through the blackness of the Pacific. He swallowed a gulp of seawater, the icy water scalding his skin as if 1,000 daggers were stabbing him. The rope around his waist went taut, jolting him sideways, sliding up beneath his armpits to tighten in a vice-like grip as the boat continued pulling him 4 feet below the surface. Twisting wildly, Harry grabbed the rope in his bound hands and desperately inched his way toward the surface. His muscles felt like lead weights, his body convulsing in spasms. Unable to make headway against the force of the churning sea, Harry released the rope, slipping back beneath the waves to drown. Just as he was about to pass out, the rope hauled him painfully from the sea. Mac reached out and pulled him aboard. Harry flopped onto the deck, gasping for air, shivering uncontrollably.
"Next time we cut the rope," Mac said.
"Wait,"
gasped Harry, fighting to speak.
"I'm CIA.
Jonas and Mac looked at each other.
"Bullshit."
"It's true. Let me warm up inside now. I'll prove it."
"Prove it here," Mac said, tossing him a wool blanket.
Harry pulled the blanket around his shoulders.
"The cell phone I gave Jonas, it has a miniature microphone and transmitter inside. I was monitoring his conversations with Celeste Singer. You told her about Devil's Purgatory."
"I did?"
"In the hospital. You sounded delirious. She must have drugged you."
"Son of a bitch."
"What's Devil's Purgatory?" Mac asked.
the location in the Mariana Trench where I piloted the Sea Cliff 11 years ago. What's so important about that spot that she would drug me and you'd want to kill me? Celeste recruited you for this trip just to get the location from you, said Harry, his teeth chattering. I knew she was getting close. Cutting the line to the Zodiac seemed an opportune way to keep you from spilling your guts.
I told you that bitch was after something, Mac said. I say we forget about having him arrested and let this piece of shit swim with the fishes.
Wait. Jonas knelt down to face Harry.
What's in the devil's purgatory that's so important? I can't tell you that.
Mac restarted the winch.
Okay, wait, I'll tell you, but only because we could use your help.
First you try to kill me, then you want my help? You got a lot of balls, mister.
They're probably turning blue about now, Mac said.
Benedict Singer has your wife, Harry said, shivering. If you want to see her alive again, you'd better untie me.
Devil's Purgatory, Mariana Trench. Like a flying saucer descending through a cloudy night sky, the Benthos dropped through the layer of soot, re-entering the isolated deep underworld of the Mariana Trench. Infrared lights revealed a forest of jagged black smokers, each billowing mushroom clouds of minerals and superheated water, the stacks rising more than 80 feet off the prehistoric seafloor. Benedict Singer stood impatiently over Professor Kwan, awaiting the results of the gas chromatography detectors.
Oh, excellent, Kwan reported. We have detected plumes of tritogenic helium-3 being vented from the seabed throughout this area.
We found similar plumes at least 12 times.
Not like these, Benedict. Not with the same concentration of helium-3. I'd say we have definitely arrived.
Sir, Epimetheus ready to launch, Captain Prokovich said. We also have an incoming message from the Goliath.
Benedict walked to the closest computer terminal and typed in his access code. A scrambled message appeared. He entered another code word to translate the cryptogram. Celeste Singer, ETA, 900 hours. Prometheus repairs complete. Additional exterior lights mounted. Crew preparing for descent. Launch time, 1,200 hours.
Excuse me, sir, Prokovich interrupted. The captain of the Epimetheus says the girl is in the docking area, requesting permission to board.
Benedict smiled in amusement.
A mouse is preparing to play her last card. Instruct Captain Warren to welcome Mrs. Taylor aboard.
Aye, sir.
Terry climbed down into the Epimetheus, taking a position adjacent to the pilot's seat.
Rig ship for dive, said the captain.
Aye, sir. Seals tight. Depressurizing hangar sleeves.
Terry studied every movement, memorizing every switch as it was activated.
Release docking clamps.
Aye, sir. Clamps released. Sub is now free of docking station.
Engage, shaft. Take us out.
Terry held on as the engine started, propelling the Epimetheus away from the Benthos, toward its destination in the Devil's Purgatory. Camouflaged by the abyssal darkness, the family of chronosaurs glided effortlessly above the warm seafloor, the adult female taking the lead. At 49 feet and 25 tons, she was nearly a third larger than her mate, and twice the size of her surviving female offspring. With her two smaller companions trailing along either side of her pelvic girdle, the behemoth reptile guided her pack in a tight triangular configuration through the gorge. The streamlined V formation was used by the creatures to conserve energy, the big female's girth creating a channel of water which actually towed the two smaller pliosaurs forward. More important, swimming close together gave the sensory appearance of a much larger creature to the chronosaur's voracious enemy, Carcharodon megalodon. Being cold-blooded fish lizards, the creatures followed a swimming pattern that kept them moving in and out of the hydrothermal vents. 70 million years ago, the species' primordial ancestors had required the heat of the sun to warm their bodies. Adapting to life in the abyss, the surviving genus now used the superheated waters of the vents to keep their body temperatures elevated, their gills allowing them to breathe in the sea. Propelling themselves forward using wide, downward strokes from their front flippers, the pliosaurs were fast, efficient hunters, their dark coloring making them nearly invisible in the blackness of the trench. Only the glow of their luminous, nocturnal eyes gave away their presence, crimson specks that lured unsuspecting fish mortally close to their powerful crocodile jaws. The creature's vision, surprisingly good for a deep-sea dweller, was capable of distinguishing the darting movements of bioluminescent fish up to 200 feet away. But when it came to stalking prey within the abyss, the chronosaurs relied on an entirely different sensory faculty. Located within the creature's external brain tissues, situated in close proximity to the nerve endings, was a high concentration of iron oxide magnetite crystals.
Like many magnets, the crystals allowed the creatures to continuously orient themselves within the trench by using the Earth's natural magnetic force fields. Over millions of years, this sensory system had evolved to the point where the chronosaurs could detect minute disturbances within the canyon's magnetic field, disturbances created by schools of fish or giant squid, or by their mortal enemy. Traveling south on their endless quest for food, the chronosaurs sensed strong disturbances along the seafloor. With a unified downstroke of their forelimbs, the three creatures moved as one to investigate. Terry stared out the tiny porthole, her mind racing. Over the last 4 hours, she had watched the vacuum tube of the Epimetheus inhale manganese nodules and sediment from the Cretaceous seafloor. At these depths, the process was extremely difficult. To pull in a cubic foot of rock in 16,000 pounds per square inch of water pressure required a 1,000-horsepower engine running for 4 minutes. Every so often, the suction process would cease, allowing one crew to remove the precious rocks from a pressurized holding chamber beneath the sub, while another serviced the equipment. The bounty had proved so plentiful that the crew had surpassed their hold limits an hour ago. Benedict had refused to allow the sub to return to the benthos. Now dozens of 10-gallon buckets overflowing with nodules littered the narrow passage, forcing the captain to climb over the rocks just to get to his control console. For the 100th time, Terry repeated the piloting sequence over and over in her head like a mantra. Closing her eyes, she imagined herself sneaking into the docking station later that night, slipping into the sub and sealing herself in. Within minutes, she would free the sub of its docking clamps, making it impossible for Benedict to prevent her escape. First, she'd maneuver the Epimetheus away from the underbelly of the benthos, then ascend quickly to clear the hydrothermal layer, removing herself from the creature's habitat. Then she'd head west, remaining in 4,000 feet of water to elude the Goliath, before surfacing to run aground somewhere along the Marianas Island chain. In her mind's eye, she saw herself climbing out of the hatch to behold a tropical island. Ditching the sub in shallow water, she'd wade to shore, the sun bathing her in its warm glow, her nightmare over forever. The radio squawk startled her.
"Captain, the Goliath has detected a single life form moving quickly in our direction. Too big to be a chronosaur. Range 16 kilometers and closing fast."
Terry's heart pumped hard and fast. A single large bioform meant a megalodon.
"What are Benedict's orders?" the captain asked.
"He wants us to continue mining the nodules while the benthos maneuvers into position directly above us."
"Inform the benthos that we are filled to capacity now," the captain said.
"Benedict's orders are to continue mining,"
relayed the radio man. The three chronosaurs circled the strange creature from a safe distance, evaluating their prey. Sensing the larger benthos approaching in the distance, the pliosaurs split up. The male and female offspring closed, intent on driving their prey away from the larger creature and toward the big female, which remained circling in the shadows. The benthos descended, dwarfing the Epimetheus within the confines of its three dangling pillar-like legs, which came to rest on the bottom. 100 feet above the submersible, the abyssal docking station spread its wing-like clamps to full capacity, waiting to guide the Epimetheus safely to the docking clamps, which would then raise the sub, sealing its conning tower within the pressurized chamber above. 4 strobe lights ignited from the benthos's hull, piercing the blackness like a lighthouse beam. Terry focused on one of the vertical shafts of light. 50 feet from her window, she saw a great gust of sediment swirl upward from the bottom. Before she could react, the 2 chronosaurs slammed headfirst into the starboard side of the Epimetheus, rolling the vessel hard to port. Terry screamed, tossed backward in total darkness, landing hard across buckets of manganese nodules. One of the crew fell over her, pinning her legs against the rocks.
"Cease mining," the captain ordered. "Drop weight plates."
Red emergency cabin lights switched on as the sub rolled upright. Terry moaned in pain as she tried to sit up. Pushing the unconscious crewman off her legs, she struggled to her feet. A droplet of water fell from a titanium plate above her head. Oh, my God! The Epimetheus rose straight up from the bottom and into the bosom of the benthos, its conning tower guided into the docking sleeve by the tightening clamps. From his vantage behind 8-inch Lexan glass, within the docking bay's control room, Benedict watched the top of the conning tower rise up into position in the flooded chamber. Brass seals moved into place around the sub's dorsal fin, while docking clamps lifted the Epimetheus into its locked position. Powerful pumps forced the water out, draining and depressurizing the vault within minutes. Terry squeezed her way toward the conning tower. She watched impatiently as Captain Warren ascended the ladder, waiting for the all-clear alarm to sound from above. Bending down, she stole a glance out another window. An immense shadow was circling close by, gathering speed.
The metallic bell sounded. Captain Warren opened the hatch. Terry forced her way up the ladder and into the damp vault. She saw Benedict in the control room speaking into a microphone.
Captain, instruct your men to unload the nodules into the docking chamber.
Sir, the Epimetheus took a beating. Can we wait?
Now, Captain.
Terry ran to the locked vault door and banged her fist against the unyielding metal.
Let us out!
Several men had already climbed out of the sub, only to be pushed back down the conning tower by their captain.
Form a line, he ordered. Get those rocks off the sub.
White buckets filled with black potato-sized rocks were carried out from the conning tower. From below, the adult female Kronosaurus glided beneath its motionless prey. Captain Warren gave Benedict a desperate glance.
Sir, we could really use some help.
Benedict watched the exhausted men struggle to lift the rocks from the sub.
Prokovich, send some of your men into the chamber to assist.
Aye, sir.
The Russian pointed to two men. Terry heard the titanium bolts click back into place. The door swung open, and two burly men pushed past her, hustling into the vault. With a tremendous surge, the 50,000-pound female Kronosaurus drove its skull upward into the belly of the Epimetheus. Red lights flashed, sirens wailed. Terry dove through the vault doorway, the door slamming shut behind her with such force that it propelled her through the air and into the far wall of the outer corridor. As she raised her head, a deafening roar echoed through the passage. Her body trembled, and for a bizarre moment, she found herself bouncing 6 inches off the floor as the benthos shuddered beneath her. She struggled to her feet and ran into the control room.
Oh, God! Oh, my God!
Its titanium hull compromised on impact. The Epimetheus had instantaneously imploded under 16,000 pounds per square inch of water pressure. As the sub folded in like a crushed aluminum can, the sea rocketed upward, blasting into the sealed docking station vault, killing everyone. The air inside compressed, superheating to thousands of degrees in a millisecond. It was the 10-foot-thick layer of titanium surrounding the chamber that prevented the benthos from imploding with the force of a small nuclear explosion. A swirling torrent of debris-infested water whipped around the circular inner walls of the flooded chamber, searching in vain for a way to pierce the titanium plating that safeguarded the rest of the mothership. As Terry watched, the whirlpool of brackish water began unraveling, revealing its devastation. Disfigured, jelly-like corpses slammed against the Lexan window, their empty eye sockets leaking rivulets of gray matter and blood. Pockets of imploded skin disfigured the bodies, masking the frozen expressions of horror from the victims' unrecognizable faces. Terry turned in disgust and fled with the others, all gagging as they escaped into the adjacent corridor for air. Only Benedict remained, staring at the kaleidoscope of human body parts and floating excrement.
Naturam expellas furca. Tamenusque recurrit, he whispered, wiping a tear from a lashless emerald eye. You may drive nature out with a pitchfork, but she will keep coming back.
He closed his eyes.
C'est la guerre.
Revelations. U.S. Naval Base, Guam. Base Commander James Adams adjusted his gold-rimmed glasses as he walked out from behind his desk to greet Masao Tanaka, motioning his secretary to close the office door behind them.
Mass, it's good to see you. I want you to meet someone. This is Dave Ross.
A short, slender, intense-looking gentleman in his early 40s stood and offered his hand.
Mr. Tanaka?
Mr. Ross is with the CIA. He has something he wants to discuss with you regarding Terry.
Maceo sat. I'm listening. Ross pulled his chair around to face the older man.
Mr. Tanaka, what's said in this room stays in this room. Are we clear on that?
Go on.
About 4 years ago, Israeli intelligence learned of a secret meeting that took place in the Sudan between a small group of Islamic terrorists and your partner, Benedict Singer. 6 months later, construction began on the Benthos, the Prometheus, and the Epimetheus. Construction paid for by funds discreetly channeled into Geotech from the Organization of Exiled Saudi Millionaire Osama bin Laden. 18 months ago, the NSA intercepted a communication that revealed the nature of Singer's meeting. It turns out that Benedict Singer had discovered a fuel source capable of sustaining fusion energy.
What do you mean by sustain?
Scientists have been experimenting with fusion power for some 40 years, Ross said. Their biggest challenge has been in containing a plasma of charged tritium or deuterium while its atoms fuse into helium. Singer's new fuel source stabilized within the shifting magnetic fields of his tokamak reactor, creating a sustained output of fusion energy. In layman's terms, he broke the fusion barrier.
Maceo raised his eyebrows, impressed.
The United States, Russia, Japan, and the European Union have been working for years to complete the ITER, which stands for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, said Ross. Singer's discovery changes everything. This new fuel source puts him 30 years ahead of ITER and the rest of the world. Maseo, the Arab Coalition bankrolling Benedict Singer, represents an organization responsible for bankrolling acts of terrorism, said Commander Adams. We simply cannot allow these factions to monopolize fusion.
What does all this have to do with me, or my daughter, for that matter?
Ross leaned forward. Bin Laden didn't spend over $1 billion so GTI could explore the oceans or deploy your Eunice robots along the seafloor of the Mariana Trench. The source of Benedict's fusion fuel originates in a remote area somewhere within the gorge. The Benthos allows Benedict to steal the fuel from within our own territorial boundaries. EEC zoning laws be damned. It's the equivalent of the United States slipping into OPEC countries in order to steal their oil.
Maseo closed his eyes in thought, absorbing the information.
I don't understand. If the CIA knows what Benedict is up to, why allow him access into the trench?
Two reasons, Ross answered. First, we only just learned the source and the true nature of this fusion fuel. Second, controlling access into a 7-mile-deep, 1,500-mile-long gorge is a lot more difficult than it sounds. We just weren't prepared.
Commander Adams walked out from behind his desk.
The Benthos is so deep that it's impossible to detect using our satellites. Sonar reconnaissance is difficult at best. The ship's engines barely give off a signature, and even if we could detect her, how would we reach her once she descended into the trench?
What about depth charges?
Even if we could pinpoint her, I doubt the explosion would cause much damage. Her hull is 108 inches of titanium.
Ross interrupted the explanation.
Our biggest fear was that Geotech would simply transport the Benthos into international waters and enter the Mariana Trench undetected, somewhere along the bottom. Fortunately, Mossad's informants revealed that Benedict Singer was searching for a scientific expedition, an excuse to legitimately enter the trench that would allow him to utilize the Goliath to shadow the Benthos along the surface as a safety precaution.
Commander Adams forced a smile.
These gigantic sharks of yours became the wild card that saved us.
Oh, wait a moment.
A dark revelation suddenly dawned on Maseo.
The new Eunice project, the lucrative Jamstack contract?
Ross shot Adams a look.
We needed to provide Benedict with a legitimate opportunity to access the Mariana Trench. The completion of the Eunice project seemed a perfect fit.
My God, how far did you people go? The class action lawsuits, the outrageous monetary awards, the court denying our right to appeal. You bastards set my company up, didn't you? You wanted us to go bankrupt.
Maseo stood, kicking back his chair.
You used my institute to bait Geotech, to entice them to buy us out in order to give them an excuse to legally enter the trench.
Commander Adams stepped in between Maseo and Ross, afraid his friend might actually strike the CIA director.
Maseo, calm down. The CIA has assured me that reparations will be made. Try to understand.
Reparations? James, do you know how much damage they've inflicted on my family?
It couldn't be helped, Adams said. You must understand what was at stake.
Maseo's face turned red with rage.
Mr. Tanaka, your daughter's life may be in danger, Ross said. If you want to help her, I advise you to sit down and let me finish.
If anything happens to my daughter...
Sir, let me finish.
Adams nodded to Maseo, replacing the elder man's chair. Maseo sat.
I'm genuinely sorry for what we put you and your family through, Ross said. Try to understand that this is not just a CIA operation, that the Japanese, Russians, and Europeans are involved as well. Benedict would have suspected we were onto him if the United States or Japan had approached him directly. We used the Tanaka Institute as a buffer. Timing was everything. Did we push you into bankruptcy? The lawsuits were real.
But the closing of the Institute, the freezing of our assets.
No comment. Let's just say we wanted to make sure you were desperate enough to contact Benedict Singer for assistance once Jamstack offered you the lucrative Eunice contract. Only Geotech possessed the resources necessary to complete the project, not to mention the money to bail you out of your financial difficulties. You were forced to sell, and we knew Benedict would grab the bait, hook, line, and sinker.
Maseo took several deep breaths, attempting to calm himself.
The biggest problem we faced, Ross continued, was figuring out what the fusion fuel source was. We got a huge break when Mossad managed to get one of their operatives aboard the Proteus. Unfortunately, the sub imploded, killing the agent before he was able to transmit the information.
One thing we did learn,
Adams said, was that Benedict entered the Mariana Trench not knowing the exact location of the fusion fuel. It turns out the Proteus had been designed to conduct a thorough search of the canyon floor. Its destruction added months to GTI's timetable. Ross stood. 2 days before the Megalodon escaped from your facility, NSA intercepted a coded transmission from the Goliath to Celeste Singer, mentioning Jonas Taylor.
Jonas?
Maceo looked up. What does Jonas have to do with this? 11 years ago, your son-in-law piloted a series of dives into the Mariana Trench aboard a Navy submersible called the Seacliff, Commander Adams explained. It was on the last of these dives that Taylor apparently ran into one of these Megalodon sharks and panicked. The two scientists aboard were both killed. Turns out they were both fusion physicists, Dick Prestes being a former colleague of one Benedict Singer. Once we realized the connection, the rest was easy, Ross said. Analysis of the remaining manganese nodules collected by the two scientists during the Seacliff dive revealed inert gases trapped within the rocks. The fusion fuel, Adams added. Ross leaned against the commander's desk. Knowing the exact location of these particular manganese nodules changes everything. We've begun preparing our own remote submersible robots to mine the rocks ourselves, hoping to avoid a direct confrontation with Singer, who still wields a lot of power in the financial and political world.
But the Benthos is already in the trench, Maceo said. How did you possibly expect to force Benedict out without him becoming suspicious?
By instituting Jamstack's investigation of the Proteus accident, Ross answered. We were hoping to use that as an excuse to force Benedict out of the trench before he could locate the nodules. Unfortunately, your daughter sent Jamstack a positive report regarding Geotech's activities in the trench, while Jonas unknowingly spilled his guts about the secret location of the dive site to Celeste Singer. Thanks to your son-in-law, the Benthos is now on its way to collect the nodules, and there's nothing we can do to stop him.
It doesn't matter, Adams said. Mossad has operatives aboard the Goliath. Once we know Benedict has found the manganese nodules and loaded them on board, the Navy will move in and confiscate the goods under EEC law.
What about my daughter? You said she's in danger.
As far as we know, she's still on board the Benthos, along with one of my best agents, said Ross. We expect them topside aboard the Goliath within the next few days. It's very important that we get them off the ship before the Navy shows up, or Benedict may resort to using them as hostages.
Which is the reason you've revealed the truth about all of this?
Maceo said.
You want me to intervene, to pick up my daughter and your agent so the Navy can move in without Benedict becoming suspicious.
Correct, Ross said. Mariana Trench. Angel remained just below the thermocline, her luminescent white skin casting an eerie light as she moved through the dark Pacific waters. As she continued south, a strange tingling sensation began buzzing within her nervous system, causing the female to shake her massive head like a horse tossing a fly. The creature's built-in compass, the Earth's powerful magnetic force field, had suddenly become distorted, the north-south current disrupted by seamounts and other geological formations surrounding the Mariana Trench. These geomagnetic anomalies were instantly recognized by the sharks ampullae of Lorenzini. Locking onto the primordial landmarks, the Megalodon began descending in a wide circular pattern, allowing her 31-ton muscular girth to gradually adjust to the dramatic changes in water pressure. Icy water bit into the creature's thick hide. Ignoring the pain, the female swam faster, the additional propulsion momentarily warming her. Down and down she descended, her core temperature dropping dangerously low. Finally, the animal plunged through the dense layer of floating minerals and sulfur, entering the warm, hydrothermal waters of the abyss. Gliding just below the cloud-like ceiling of silty debris, Angel cast her moonlight glow upon the ancient gorge, just as her ancestors had over the last 100,000 years. The female descended, warming herself in the dissipating heat flowing from the Earth's furnace, before continuing south along the canyon floor. Hours later, the Megalodon's receptor system detected another life form approaching quickly. The female turned to intercept, heading for the source of the vibrations that were rapidly stimulating her reproductive system. Looming out of the darkness ahead was the male. At 58 feet and 46,000 pounds, the shark was distinctly smaller, though quicker than its would-be mate. Avoiding a head-on confrontation, the male circled warily, then came up from behind the big female. Highly stimulated, Angel permitted the male to slide up along her left flank. With the thrust of its tail, the male shark lurched forward, biting into the female's left pectoral fin, beginning the act of copulation.
Angel arched her spine and inverted, rolling over the male megalodon's dorsal surface to swim on her back as she twisted below her smaller mate. The two prehistoric great whites now swam belly to belly, the male on top. Mounting its mate, the male slid one of its two rigid claspers into the female's cloaca as it reestablished a biting grip upon her inverted pectoral fin. For several minutes, the two predators remained locked together in insemination, the male biting deeper in a futile attempt to control the vicious female. Copulation complete, the exhausted male slid its clasper free, momentarily releasing its grip on the female's pectoral fin. Still inverted, Angel lunged forward and snapped her open jaws over her mate's dangling caudal fin, severing the entire lower lobe of the half-crescent moon appendage before the male could react. Writhing in agony, the male fluttered the remains of its tail in a futile effort to escape. Angel rolled over, continuing her attack upon her mate's mutilated tail. Propelling herself forward, she hyperextended her 9-foot maw clear over the anal fin, her razor-sharp lower teeth shredding both claspers, ravaging the male's reproductive organs. The helpless male shook in convulsions, its lower torso writhing in spasms within the female's jaws. Angel bit down harder and hung on, content to wait until its mate died, the male's warm blood streaming into her open gullet. Finally, with a brutal thrashing of her head, Angel severed her mate's lower torso. Trailing a river of crimson, the mangled body of the lifeless male fell from the female's mouth, the head and remains of the upper torso caroming off a black smoker before dropping slowly to the seafloor. Within minutes, swarms of albino crustaceans arrived to devour the remains, the sinister circle of life complete. Having disposed of the threat to her future brood, the queen hunter continued south along the canyon wall, exploring her new kingdom. Devil's Purgatory. Mariana Trench. Captain Prokovich paused at the double doors, where the heavy bass notes of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana resounded into the corridor. He rubbed the sweat from his palms and ran his fingers through the spikes of his red crew cut. Without bothering to knock, he entered Benedict's stateroom. Benedict was lying back on a black suede couch, eyes closed, enveloped by the brooding music. Sensing another presence, he opened his eyes and, using the remote, turned down the sound.
"Your men have finished?"
"Da!"
Benedict noticed the sullen expression on his captain's face.
"You're troubled by our losses."
"It was preventable. We took risks."
"There is risk in all things great."
"Perhaps we should slow down and better prepare ourselves for these creatures."
"Vladislav, slowing down is a luxury we cannot afford. If we hesitate to complete our mission, ITER will complete it for us. Misfortune puts men to the test. Would you prefer the deaths of our comrades to have been in vain?"
"No."
"Then let us finish the task at hand."
Prokovich led him to the docking bay, which had been hastily drained and cleansed. Benedict smelled traces of ammonia. Professor Kwan was inspecting several dozen buckets filled with manganese nodules. He turned to Benedict, smiling.
"Our test results were positive. You have found the gift of Prometheus himself."
"How much is here?"
"Enough to supply power to every industrial nation for the next several years."
Benedict shook his head.
"It's not enough. We need to acquire the rest before the Americans discover our secret and seal off the area."
"How?"
Prokovich asked, pulling nervously at his eye patch.
"The creatures are still circling. They won't leave the area with so much of our crew's blood in the water."
Benedict gave him a reassuring look.
"As we speak, an array of high-powered lights are being mounted along the hull of the Prometheus. Lights that will keep the pliosaurs at bay. As an additional precautionary measure, the benthos will ascend to a position 50 meters above the hydrothermal layer, where the creatures dare not venture. From now on, we'll escort the Prometheus on her way to the seafloor, then back again to the coal layer as she transports the manganese nodules to the Goliath."
"Aye, sir, and the girl?"
Benedict smiled.
"And now that we've located the nodules, she's no longer needed. She'll be dead before the day is out."
Terry sat on the edge of the bed, staring at the cabin door, now bolted from the outside, preventing her escape. Every few minutes a wave of panic would rush over her, forcing her to pace back and forth frantically until the nervous energy dissipated, and she'd again collapse onto the mattress, waiting for her jailer to take her to her execution.
"Benedict locked me in here for a reason. His mind games are over. He's ready to kill me."
Desperate,
She grabbed the desk chair and smashed it repeatedly against the locked door until the furniture broke apart in her hands. She tried the door again and saw the knob had loosened. Encouraged, she searched the cabin for something to pry open the lock. Terry grabbed the wood desk and flung it over, hoping to break off one of its legs. That's when she noticed the ventilation grill. Captain Prokovich and his crew stared nervously at the row of closed-circuit monitors whose gray and white images revealed the undercarriage of the Benthos. Running the length of the monolith's flat undercarriage was a myriad of pressurized tanks resembling rows of giant pontoons. Half of these containers controlled the ship's ballast by drawing in seawater, allowing the positively buoyant Benthos to sink. The other half held gasoline, which, being lighter than water, helped maintain neutral buoyancy. The three chronosaurs continued to circle the undercarriage of the Benthos, apparently excited by the taste of blood. The sound of the ship's powerful hydraulic rams forcing seawater from numerous catches along the lower levels had caught the creature's attention. The predator's attention was now focused on the giant pontoons. To their nocturnal eyes, the containers resembled the size and shape of the Epimetheus, a life form that had proven a bountiful source of food. As the Benthos rose away from the seafloor, the predators began biting into the titanium containers. Benedict entered the bridge.
"Report, Captain."
"We've got a new problem," Prokovich pointed to the monitors. "The creatures have begun attacking the ballast tanks."
"The containers are too thick, even for these monsters."
"Agreed, sir. However, it is possible for them to cause an indentation along the surface of the cylinder. If this should happen, the extreme pressures could gain a foothold, increasing compressive stresses."
"And the tank would rupture?"
"Aye, sir. We've suffered no damages as of yet, but the creatures appear to be getting bolder."
1,200 feet to hydrothermal ceiling,"
a crewman called out. Benedict watched in fascination as an enormous flat head appeared in one of the monitors. With an incredible burst of speed, the animal slammed into one of the gasoline tanks, attempting to tear it from the flat cowling undercarriage of the ship. The sound of metal being forcefully bent could be heard by crewmen working on G-deck. Within seconds, the enormous pressure of the trench exposed the cylinder's flaw. The damaged tank ruptured and imploded, setting off a rapid chain reaction that jolted the Benthos sideways. Lights flickered off, and the ship was immersed in darkness. Moments later, red emergency lights blazed on as the monolith's backup system powered on. Prokovich picked himself up from the floor. The Benthos had stopped rising and was now listing 10 degrees to port.
"Damage report."
"Sir, ballast tanks B4 through B8 are gone. We're also losing gasoline from tanks G5, G8, and G9.
Another explosion and concussion rocked the Benthos. For a long moment, the crew stared wide-eyed at Benedict, uncertain of what would happen next. Then, as if Mother Nature herself had commanded its return, the great ship began falling back to the seafloor. Western Pacific. The helicopter soared over the deep blue Pacific, Max searching the ocean for the decommissioned Soviet warship.
"There she is,"
he said, pointing to a gray shape on the horizon. Jonas eyed the Goliath through his binoculars before passing them back to Harry Moon.
"You sure Celeste's on board?"
"We're sure," Harry said. "Once she found out the location of the Devil's Purgatory, she hightailed it off the William Beebe. She never had any interest in recapturing her shark. She only wanted your information."
"And how will you know when Benedict's actually located these nodules?" Mac asked.
"We'll know the moment he begins shuttling his two submersibles between the trench and the Goliath. Our objective is to get Terry and our agent off the ship without arousing suspicion. Once Benedict's completed the mining job, the Navy will move in."
Jonas felt a knot in his stomach. "What makes you so sure they'll release Terry?"
"She knows nothing about their operation," Harry said, "and Benedict will want to keep it that way. The William Beebe's right behind us. The last thing Benedict wants is a bunch of civilians hanging around the Goliath while billions of dollars worth of manganese nodules are being loaded on board. When Celeste realizes that we're not leaving without Terry, she'll have her brought topside before the William Beebe arrives."
"And what if my wife has already figured out what's really going on in the trench?" Harry shook his head.
"Let's just pray she hasn't."
Max set the chopper down on the foredeck next to another helicopter. One of the Goliath's crew waited until the overhead rotor slowed before greeting the unwelcome guests.
"Please come with me," said a crewman in a somber tone.
As they followed him aft, Jonas could see men working on an enormous white cigar-shaped submersible, situated on a hydraulic platform in the stern. Two arrays of underwater lights were being mounted along either side of the sub's hull. Jonas noticed the ship's name painted in red across the keel, Prometheus. He recalled the name from a course on Greek mythology taken long ago as an undergraduate at Penn State. Prometheus was the Titan god who had stolen the sun's power, giving it to humans to survive. Benedict's ego's showing. Jonas recognized the frail figure standing by the starboard rail.
Maceo!
He felt his heart tighten as his father-in-law turned to him, teary-eyed.
I'm sorry.
Maceo, what happened? Tell me!
Tari's dead,
he rasped, his almond eyes swollen from crying. Jonas felt his legs weaken as a shock ran through his gut. Mac and Harry grabbed him,